He has a thing for tickling.
Who does?
Principal Wade, Roger, tickles the children.
Where?
In his office.
I mean, where on the body?
Their feet. Sometimes a child will go to his office for disciplinary reasons. That's when it happens.
Is it punishment?
I think it's supposed to mitigate the punishment, but then he gives them money.
For what?
Nickels. He gives them nickels if they can withstand the tickling.
Okay, well, that is odd.
It's completely inappropriate.
Does anybody talk with him about it?
The board questioned him. Nothing happened.
But somebody took it to the police.
I did, at the urging of some parents.
Parents asked you to go to the police?
I talked to a detective Barr. He said he'd look into it, write something up. That was 5 months ago.
Have you seen a report?
No, it's like the whole thing went away.
So listen, this thing with Roger Wade.
Who?
The principal at Shady Lane Elementary.
The foot tickler?
After I talked to the superintendent, the school board had a meeting.
You gotta be kidding.
They're begging us to look into it.
They're begging?
They're asking.
Our LEAA review is coming up. What are you still doing on this goose chase?
Greg can finish the paperwork. Let's give this a day. There are some meaningful signs here.
You're not dragging me into this.
What's the point of all this if we don't apply it to the real world?
We're trying to save women from getting pulled into vans and cut to pieces. Not crucify some school marm who hasn't done anything.
Yet. Certainly our goal is to be preemptive.
We're the FBI, Holden. That is not our goal. Yet.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler and former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today in the studio is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard and co-creator and executive producer of The Case Of.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clemente is my colleague.
Well,
here we are.
We are kicking off the home stretch on the series Mindhunter. And I'm still enthralled with this series. I think it's an amazingly well-shot, well-directed, well-written series about historical fact. Of course, there's a little playing around with
the truth,
but it is great. It's a really cool thing, and I will try my best to point out the things that were kind of a stretch and the ones that are actually right on.
Right, and I will do my best to point out all of Dr. Wendy's blouses, which, as our Facebook... listeners know, I am obsessed with the choice of blouses. Anyway, so this is episode 8. Now,
I thought it was the wallpaper that you were obsessed with.
I'm obsessed with everything.
You've now switched into Dr. Wendy Carr's blouses. What's going on, Lisa?
Oh, and one of our listeners, I will share with you later, has an amazing interpretation of why she's the whole cat and the food and the whole, all of that. But we'll get to that.
But Laura, you missed her biggest obsession, and that is redheaded men, even if they're serial
redheaded
killers.
Redheaded men.
Oh, God, yeah.
So has this moved on from the Bobs? So from the Bobs, we get to redheaded men, to wallpaper.
So.
Long-time listeners will know. That's a shout-out to Bob Ruff. Anyway.
Okay, and lots been happening since I've been away, it seems.
Much. Yeah, so I would call this episode, no matter what the title is, The Tickler.
Right.
Because the through and through theme is a principal who has taken it upon himself to, well, improve the statistics and scores and an atmosphere at his school. But one of the things he does is he tickles students instead of disciplining them.
Right. Inserts pleasure for punishment, as one of the teachers says. But before we get to that, let's set up this what's happening here.
Okay.
So Holden has a back to school night or whatever. He's coming into this elementary school. It seems like at the invitation of this principal. So the principal, Roger Wade, Principal Wade, is set up as to be a good guy. I mean, he comes across as somebody who's very concerned for the students. He doesn't want Holden to use words like deviant and pyromania and torture and mutilation, because he's worried about their innocence being kind of shattered and the parents freaking out.
Well, he's thinking that it should be age appropriate, which is quite right.
Yep.
That any time you talk to children or you educate them, it should be age appropriate. So that's perfectly...
And I think Agent Ford was being a little dense when he was not taking the hint on that one.
Yeah, he doesn't have kids. He doesn't have any sense of what's appropriate and what's not appropriate.
Whatever.
Yeah,
Hollywood.
Anyway, for Hollywood, yeah. So he goes, and by the way, I want to shout out this actor who plays Principal Michael Waid is Mark Cuddish. He's been nominated any number of times for Tony Awards. He's an amazing actor. If you watched Billions, you saw him as sort of like the Tony Robbins guru, mano a mano, chest thumping motivational
what
guy
do you there. Think about his suits, Lisa? His brown tie and his yes. suits. So anything to say about
very,
his...
So notice how it's very normal. I'm using air quotes. So it's very tweedy and calming. It's beige upon beige. There's nothing that kind of shakes up. He's very vanilla, you know, something very calming and trusting about him. Anyway, I'll stop. But so my question is, so what is Holden really doing there? Is he there to kind of warn the children about red flags to be on the lookout for as far as seeing psychopaths in their playmates? Or is he trying to get information from them? Like if this is, if you see, you know, a playmate who's setting their cats on fire, you know, come and tell me. You
know, I don't know if tell me, but yes, he wants people to report on their classmates because he says in a class this size, one of you typically could become a psychopath and could be doing bad things. And he has to find vanilla ways of saying it. And the kids ask great questions. And it's really a great, it's a great scene. But the long and short of it is that the teacher actually stops him as he's leaving and says, I want to talk to you because I've seen disturbing behavior. And while they're doing it, you look back down the hallway with them and you see the principal holding both of the hands of this little girl and then sort of, I don't know, either tussling her hair or putting his hand on her shoulder, and then she goes off. And that, there's just a little creepiness in the music. So you're like, what's going on there? And then we find out that he has a practice of not only tickling children's feet instead of punishing them. So when somebody gets sent to the principal, typically, that's because they're in trouble. But instead of acting like they're in trouble, he makes them take off their shoes and their socks, and he tickles their feet. And then, if they can, quote, withstand the tickling, he gives them a nickel.
Well, what do you think about that, Jim Clementi?
Grooming with a capital G.
Exactly.
Yes. So the struggle in this episode is what is deviant and what is disturbing and the line between that. And Holden continually questioning himself, like, am I just seeing this with the jaundiced eyes of my profession? Because I see so many psychopaths or so many people like Brutus who this is, they also have this obsession.
Well, I think it's in there for that exact reason, right? Because definitely when we are exposed to people who are the extreme of human behavior, when we see the worst things that humans do to other humans, of course, we're more sensitive to it. But we can also see, because of the interviews that they're doing, we can also see how those people started and how there's nuisance offenses that they start with typically, whether that's peeping or stealing lingerie or breaking and entering, those kinds of nuisance offenses.
Gateway type offenses, we might call them as well.
Right, that eventually lead to much more serious offenses. So we do kind of have our red flags and our radars perking up when we see those kinds of nuisance offenses in any environment. And what's interesting about this, how this all plays out, is that there's sort of becomes a, I don't know, a back and forth between Ford and Dr. Wendy about this. And it will actually come to a head later. So when we get down to that, we'll talk about it. But basically, Ford is questioning whether or not this is something that they should be involved in. I mean, this is the FBI, for Christ's sakes. Really? Somebody tickling?
I have a question for you guys, if you've ever experienced this. So when I was, a million years ago, when I was in first grade, we had a teacher who's a yard duty teacher, very zoftig lady, very big, jolly lady. I think her name was Schultze or something like that. And she would scoop us up during playtime, during recess, and she'd hold us in her arms and she would like shake, like boom, 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 and our little legs would like flop all around, and we would laugh and giggle, and she'd set us down and we kind of stagger away, and we loved it, you know. And there was, it was just different than like touching a kid. Now, I taught preschool, and there's no way I would ever hug a kid now, you know.
Well, and I think, you know, that, what year was that? What grade was that?
A while ago, several decades ago.
No, I don't mean what year. I meant what year in school.
Oh, first grade, sorry.
All right, so 5 years old, is that 4 or 5 years old?
Probably 6 or 7, yeah.
And there's certain mothering type behaviors that may be appropriate, mm-hmm. and there's certain non-mothering type behaviors yeah. that, but here's the key. When parents of that mm-hmm. child or those children say to that teacher, don't do that, and they continue to do that, that becomes an issue.
Right.
And so there may be some innocent behavior like that. And let's say this principal was confronted and he was asked, hey, why are you doing that? And he says, well, I just kind of like it or whatever. I think it's a good thing to do. Well, these parents don't want you to do it, so stop. If he said, oh, okay, fine, that would be one thing. But when he says, oh my God, how dare you, yeah. you perverted,
yeah,
whatever, you know, he's throwing it back at the agent.
He's deflecting, yeah, he and is. Distracting.
He can't
let go
of it. He can't, yeah.
Well, so.
Okay, so he leaves the thing and he goes back. So he sees Deb being driven home by another guy in this spiffy little MG with a top down. And he poses it to her, to his girlfriend, because she's studying sociology. And he's like, you know, do you think that this is harmless fun? And she's like, no, this is fucking creepy.
And she literally says, nickels for tickles. Creepy.
Right. So she's clear. And she thinks it's similar to Brutus, you know, the compulsion for feet and that it's escalating. And will this escalate? Do you think that, I mean, you can't tell at this point, right?
No.
You can't.
No.
If he would escalate.
No, but I think it raised the issue, right? One of the teachers says, how long before he starts asking them to take off other things other than their shoes and socks? And what is he doing outside of school? And what does this actually mean? And so what this is driving towards is this some sort of compulsive behavior that would indicate a fetish, which is sexual in nature, which could very well be a paraphilia. Now, paraphilia is the sexual attraction to an inanimate object or a non-consenting party, and children being under the age of consent, cannot consent to sexual activity. So one of the biggest questions that's asked throughout this section of the episode is, well, is this really a big deal? Well, at that time, what they're trying to convey is at the time, we didn't look at non-traditional sexual activity as a problem. But I will say that in my time in the behavioral analysis unit, we helped to prosecute people for spanking children, for a doctor for giving enemas to children, a doctor for measuring minutely every bone in a child's body because he got off sexually on those things, because all of these offenders got off sexually on those things. And just because it's not traditional sex doesn't mean it's not a crime. And so this is sort of pointing that out. And I think as we go through this episode, we're going to find out more to support that.
Yeah, and of course, you know, it's a nod to the time, you know, going back in time. You know, where we are now, you would hope in 2018 that, you know, this very concerning behaviour, he wouldn't keep his job, right? You know, if you've got one parent complaining, if you've got two, if you've got multiple, then that should be on the radar. But abuse doesn't happen in a vacuum. It's not, you know, something that just happens on its own. There is a continuum. And yes, as Jim said, there are paraphilias and things that, you know, I've worked on an offender who had a particular inclination for leather, and he would assault women getting off of trains in southeast London to try and get their leather goods, whether it's leather gloves or leather trousers. And he would actually be violent to get that leather item that Wow. he wanted. I mean, so much was he fixated upon leather. So, you know, things that are outside of sort of, you know, the norm. I always say, well, what's normal? Because, you know, one person's fantasy can be very different from someone else. But if it's someone who's non-consenting or an object, then that tends to be in the paraphilia bracket. I certainly think, you know, watching those scenes, I mean, it was creepy stuff. I mean, it's stuff that, you know, should put the hairs up on the back of your neck and make you feel uncomfortable the way that he was interacting
right.
With the children.
Then Holden goes to see, he goes to see the police.
He goes to talk to, he talks to a number of people, doesn't he? He talks to Debbie.
Yeah, he goes to see the detective. He goes to see the detective. And boy, this guy not only gives zero shits, he actually thinks that the teacher is some kind of, like, she has extra energy because she's not
whoa.
Married.
Yeah, wow. Talk about misogyny.
There we go. I mean, it's across the whole of this series.
Yeah.
which is kind of ironic that two FBI agents are trying to work out violence against women and girls and haven't quite understood misogyny in there. But this is a cultural shift again from where they were to where things are now.
Right. It seems mostly like the law enforcement around them don't have a clue. And, you know, the police is like, tickling is not a crime. He shouldn't have to explain that to the FBI.
Well, this is the resistance to looking at non-traditional sexual behavior as sexual behavior. And that, of course, has changed over time, but this is the initiation of that in terms of how law enforcement deals with things.
Holden's getting ready to go back to Oregon to see Jerry Brutus, and Bill is like, I'm not going. No, you can have that.
Why do you think that is?
That's a really good question. I feel like he feels dirty. Like there's something purient about the questioning that he feels is crossing a line, maybe?
Right.
What do you think?
He's supposed to be a profiler. He's supposed to be doing this research, and you can't let yourself
the subject matter, right?
Right. You can't let yourself get sidetracked on the details and to the detriment of the actual research you're doing. So I just didn't understand that, but maybe they wanted a more intimate moment between Ford and Brutus, and they got it. They really got it.
My intuition is what started this. I wanted to interview Kemper. Without me, there would be no study, no funding.
So now you know everything, is that it? Now you're a Superman with X-ray vision?
No, but I think I should be allowed a single day to...
predict if someone might commit a crime? Who are you, the fucking thought police?
I guess I wanted to ask you both. I mean, you guys have had partners in the past. I mean, is there a lot of conflict about how to move forward with somebody, or somebody is more aggressive, or somebody's more this or that? I mean, how do you navigate those relationships?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times it comes down to who's the senior person, you know, in that pair, and you know how well they work together. I mean, it is a partnership, and it's something that, you know, you have to realize there's give and take. And one of the most brilliant things about the behavioral analysis unit, or at this time behavioral science unit, was that they literally encouraged people from different perspectives to come in, so that they didn't have just repeating the same old thing over and over again. People would challenge each other. People would question what they're doing, and you'd have to actually support your theories with good, solid arguments and logic and evidence. And that would be how, in the end, we would come up with these profiles. So I think that this is a good indication of why that's a good thing, because they're not just yes-menning each other. They're actually questioning what the other one's doing. And I think they're both learning along the process.
Laura, do you have any experiences you want to share?
Well, I mean, in any, you know, partnership, you've got to work through your own dynamics, haven't you, of, you know, what works in a given situation. And I mean, even when Jim and I do the case of, you know, we have to get a simpatica so that we know who's going to lead on certain interviews. And, you know, you have to find that kind of, you know, harmony. You don't want to be doing that in the room, you know, when you're interviewing someone, whether they're a witness, a victim, you know, perpetrator. So it takes time. I mean, here you've got them doing very new pioneering things. And like any relationship, there's going to be some, you know, critical tests along the way. And when the younger one starts to lead things, perhaps, you know, the older one doesn't feel quite so happy about that dynamic. And particularly when he starts to take things in certain directions.
Yeah, which... I mean, he's certainly doing some bold things in this episode or these next few episodes. There's some pretty crazy things that happen. And so we'll get into them as they as they reveal themselves. But when Ford is with Brutus, this is a perfect example of how these offenders differ. So offenders who are still claiming innocence and still have appeals generally didn't want to actually talk to us about what really happened. So that didn't stop us. And so what we ended up finding out, and this is a perfect example of it, is that they will create this fiction of, oh, they were set up. But I can probably help you with insights about the killer, the real killer, and that's in air quotes, or inverted commas, sorry. And so Brutus would then talk about the killer, and he'd say, well, maybe the first one fell into his arms, and he got a taste for it. So he's revealing what he really went through, and he's protecting himself for his appeal.
As long as he's talking about it in the hypothetical.
Right.
Yeah.
But what's great is that, you know, you can see that he's reliving things, he's leaking information, and, you know, he basically says, because, right, there were no photos in the first one, but he was prepared for the next three. So he's actually telling Ford, pay attention. This is how you know whether somebody planned this or not. Look at the details.
This is based on the real Jerry Brutus, and so they do talk about how he would kill the women from behind. Can you talk about somebody who does that? I mean, what is it that they're... Can you just kind of go into that a little more?
Yeah, well, as they say in this, is that a sexual sadist will want to look into the eyes of the person they're killing because they enjoy that. They want to see the fear. Somebody who's not sadistic but wants to get to the next side of that, 100% control. They're just killing to keep the person from fighting. They're just killing because they want to deal with a part of that person, not the whole person. And so choking from behind, killing from behind, gives them that opportunity. They don't have to look at their face. Again, a sadist would enjoy that part, so they'd want to look at their face. So somebody who doesn't do that, he's actually leaking out information about himself or herself and their motives.
I mean, I'll weigh in with, you know, Brutus is about power and control. And I think what's interesting is, yes, the third party part, but his ability to compartmentalize and disassociate. And that, you know, I tend to see and have seen in many cases. And I think that teaches Holden a lot, this particular experience of how perpetrators can do the most heinous things, but then kind of normalize it, rationalize it, disassociate from it, and just compartmentalize it and carry on with sort of everyday life. And so there are lots of lessons here for not just Holden, for everybody to try and understand violence and those who perpetrate it.
Right. Yeah. And I think one of the other things that Brutus revealed was that he had been fantasizing about this for a long time before. He didn't just do it out of thin air, but when it first happened, he didn't plan that particular event. But once it did happen, well, that just opened the floodgates. He also revealed that he used a ruse, that he said, you know, women generally want to be told they look like a model, and so he's able to get women to come with him voluntarily until he forces them to do particular things. Then they realize, oh my God, I'm in a bad situation. And then he tells them, well, if you do this, then I'll let you go. Of course, he doesn't have any intention of doing that at all.
Right. And what does he say? That's what you get when you want people to look at you.
Right. That's just a horrible, horrible thing.
So again, this is a good nod to the tools and tactics that perpetrators use. And, you know, he's understood people's vulnerability, women's vulnerability, and how to talk them into a situation and how to get their guard down. And he enjoys the power and control and the thrill of the chase. And, you know, it's a nod to the masks that people wear and the masks that perpetrators wear. And certainly in cases of, you know, serial killers, and they don't kill all the time. There can be lots of things that they do in between, and, you know, they can compartmentalize those things so they can get on with everyday life, and appearances can be very normal at times. And I think this whole dialogue really lends itself to that education and awareness for the young Holden.
So he leaves Dear Jerry and he goes back to Quantico just in time to see Bill and Wendy interviewing a candidate, because I guess, you know, their workload is increasing and they need more people to join the BAU. And so I have to point out that Wendy at this point is wearing a black and white blouse, so there's no color in it, but has very distinct graphic, very Givenchy, if you will, or a Diane Furstenberg graphic blouse. And I'll talk about that more in a minute. So she's blending more in. She's, you know, she's black and white, but she's maintaining her sharpness and her focus. Anyway, so they're interviewing a guy. Seems like a good guy. Bill loves him. He thinks he's a great candidate. And what does Wendy say? Remember?
He's African American.
Yes. Actually, Holden says he's black. And Bill's like, well, nothing gets past you. But yeah, so she brings up the point that most serial killers are racist. And so they would never open up to an African American FBI agent. Do you feel like that's true?
Well, I think that's an overgeneralization, but I can understand it. But Judd Ray, who was African American, was an exceptional profiler. And he did multiple interviews in the real world. But I think it's another nod to the times.
Yeah.
And it's very unfortunate because I think this candidate was qualified and energetic and could definitely have added to it. Instead, they got a goofball
yes.
from the boss,
yes.
who turned out to be a snitch and kind of a bad guy, actually, I think.
Yeah, so McBossy Pants comes in and he has handpicked a candidate for them to interview, Greg Smith, played by great actor Joe Tuttle. And they interview him. And, you know, Holden, of all people, is like rolling his eyes because this guy seems so Squaresville. You know, he's a married man, two kids. He comes across as kind of a very Dudley Do-Right. And Dr. Wendy grabs onto something interesting because he says that he's Catholic, and she says, do you believe in good and evil? And he's like, yes, ma'am. And she's like, I don't think that binary thinking is good for this task. It's going to hamstring you. Can you talk about she means by that?
Being judgmental in these interviews is the last thing you want to do, because we're trying to encourage people to talk about horrific, horrendous, disgusting things that they did. And the way to do that is to build rapport, not to judge them. And if he looks at things in that black and white way, then he's not going to be able to break that mold and actually build rapport with these people.
Okay, and Holden doesn't like him because he thinks he's a mole for Shepard, and that turns out to be very prescient,
it turns out. Pretty much.
Okay, so let's get to can I get to the tuna, to the...
I actually want to go back to why you keep picking up Dr. Wendy's blouse, Lisa.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, tell us a little bit more about that, because I'd also heard that Fincher likes to get very, very involved, and so he picks out a lot of...
Absolutely.
Is it a Fincher-related item in terms of her clothing to blend or to make a point across scenes? Can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Yes, so I talked about this probably ad nauseum in the last time, but... He's involved in every aspect of this production, even though that he only directed 4 out of the 10 episodes. He's there on the set every day. He's making all these decisions. And kind of a hallmark of his work is every detail, every color, every shape, everything has an impact to him. You know, he's very visual, very graphic creator.
That's interesting.
Things that we wouldn't necessarily do in Criminal Minds. I mean, we wouldn't want the audience to be impacted really by the wallpaper or what somebody's wearing. You don't want them to notice it, you know. And this is all on a subconscious level. So before, in the episode before, she's wearing a bright chartreuse. It just jars with the rest of everybody. Everybody else is in, high and tight, black and white.
So he's trying to stand her out as being something different.
Right. Not only by her blouse, but by, her ideas are jarring with everybody, And now it's interesting that she's still kind of jarring. She's got a bold pattern, but the color is gone. And so she's blending in slightly more. And you'll see as we go deeper and deeper into this episode, the color is gone. She wears a beige shirt by the end.
So is that saying that she's becoming a part of?
I think when she needs to blend in, and she and Bill, especially when she and Bill are on the same side, as they become kind of the mommy and daddy of this, they look like a unit. So I wanted to tell you what one of our listeners said, which I thought was really interesting. So listener Rebecca is, maybe it's just me, but I thought her feeding the cat was supposed to be symbolic of the guys trying to lure out these killers by using bait. She keeps putting the bait out, and it seems like the cat is eating it. But then she finds the can with bugs all over it, and I felt like that maybe represented how you put out the
maggots.
Maggots, yes. And it doesn't pay off, and you just get a mess, like with Speck. So, I don't know, just my thoughts on the cat thing. Love you guys and hearing your take.
Well, that is an interesting take.
Yeah.
It's metaphorical. I did think that, I don't know if it's this episode or is it the next one where she actually gets the can and it's filled. I think it was roaches or something.
Mm-hmm.
They were insects and she was disgusted by it and she dropped the thing. And it turned, to me, it was about sort of turning a nice gesture into something horrible and disgusting.
Yeah.
I thought it meant that maybe the cat died and wasn't there eating food anymore. Because, every one of those scenes where she's feeding the cat, I don't know, it's kind of creepy and foreboding. Yeah. So to have it pay off in this way, I thought, oh, the cat must have lost their life.
Right.
So we're not going to see the cat and the, well, we're not going to see the tuna and the whole feeding go across to season two then. You think that was just the end of the...
I think so. Maybe the cat will show up again. Who knows?
Okay.
Watch this space on season two.
That's right.
But you were pointing out the wine.
The generous pours of wine, yes, white wine.
Oh, my God.
And her diet is interesting.
Tuna and white wine.
I love it.
Yeah. I mean, she's, you know, super smart, super talented at what she does, super skinny. I mean, she's just surviving on tuna and white wine from the looks of things. I'm not sure that's the best diet. I think we've all been there, probably not eating particularly well, Jim, with long hours of maybe grabbing cereal at, you know, 11 at night. But
yeah, for me, that has the opposite effect. I don't stay skinny that way.
Right.
Junk food does not do well. But when you're on the road, you know, it's just the only thing you can do, really.
Yeah, it's not always the best diet that goes with this work, but maybe it's a nod to that, who knows?
What if some guy were tickling Brian's feet?
Don't bring my kid into this.
Not just some guy, but a guy in power, the head of the school where he will be for years. He not only tickles Brian, but he gives him money for putting up
with him. Do not use my family as an example.
You ask him to stop and he won't do it. You go to the police and they blow it off. So it looks like Brian is gonna get paid to get his feet tickled and who knows what else, and there's nothing you can do about it.
I tell him to take his fucking hands off my kid. Just like I'm telling you to stop using him as an excuse for your unprofessional behavior.
So Holden wants to get back to the foot tickler, right? And he's the school board wants him to look into it, and he wants to be preemptive and apply things to the real world. And Bill says, look, we're trying to save women from being pulled into vans and cut into pieces, not crucify some school marm who hasn't done anything.
Right.
You know? Yeah, but you know what? What he's doing is absolutely spot on, that preemptive stuff. You know, it's what we were doing at the Homicide Prevention Unit at New Scotland Yard and trying to do early education, intervention and prevention. I mean, this just shows, I don't know if they were doing it back then, Jim, whether this is a nod, you know, in reality to whether John Douglas and others did pop into schools and start to get involved in those conversations.
I don't recall if they actually did that, but I'm sure they did try to get preemptive with local law enforcement at the very least. But in this case, what was great is, yeah, Ford goes out with the new guy and
Agent Dudley Do-Right. They go
and
together.
They start interviewing more teachers and they're getting people on both sides of the fence about this. And there's some catty stuff going back and forth. And then they interview a set of parents. And I thought that was really interesting. And these parents said, look, you know, we don't want them tickling our son. What the hell is this all about? You know, maybe if they were, you know, toddlers, but good Lord, my son's like 8, 9, 10 years old. Why would he be doing that? And, you know, there's a little back and forth because the father is like, well, it didn't really bother him, but whatever. But then they said, but we asked him to stop. And he got indignant. And he said he wouldn't stop. Shouldn't parents be able to control that kind of thing? And of course they should. And it's just asinine that he wouldn't stop. Yeah. And it tells you something about his fixation on it when he doesn't stop when parents tell him to.
His need-driven behavior.
There you go. Need and desire-driven behavior. And so what he says, what ends up happening is Holden decides, well, it's time to confront him. Mm-hmm. Let's confront him and see if he stops. And what the principal does is immediately try to flip it back on them. What do you do? The FBI is telling me how to deal with my students?
Right. Before they confront him, though, as you said, they interview two more teachers, and one of them is, like, right on board with the first teacher, right. Janet. She just thinks it's totally inappropriate. But then the other younger teacher is like, I love this guy. Right. He makes it so much easier for us.
A victim of grooming.
Mm-hmm.
He's great. An enabler. Singing his praises and saying he's a nice guy to me and so a nice guy to that person. Well, that's no reference or character reference for a, you know, somebody who may well be abusive or abusing somebody.
And this is how this episode actually reminded me very much of the Nassar thing, because when they confront him, he is, as you say, unapologetic and spins the story and explains this behavior away to the point that Agent Dudley Do-Right kind of is smiling, like, yeah, I love tickling my kids.
Well, you mean he claims the narrative and he turns it round? Yes. Seriously? I mean, and that's so, what they do. That's what they're very good at.
That is exactly what happened in one of my cases. And so I was literally on the phone with the prosecutor and an investigator, and this is what happened. A 5 or 6 year old boy was visiting a friend's house. When he comes back, he said, when Joey's father gave me a shower, he spent a lot of time washing my penis. And the prosecutor, who happened to be a female, said, well, my husband washes my son's penis when they take a shower, so what's the big deal? What's the big deal is, this is not his son. There's no reason for a 5 or 6 year old to have somebody wash their penis. They're old enough to do it themselves. And especially if it's not your kid. But by taking that situation and thinking of it in the context of your own children, you miss the biggest glaring red flag in the world. Why is this guy doing it to other children, not their own children? So there's that. But also, when he's talking, when Holden's talking to the parents, they said that when they told him they didn't want him to do it, he said two things. One, you're not going to deny your son my affection. And two, my covenant is not with you, the parents. Mm-hmm. It's with your son.
That word.
And yeah. Both of those things are very disturbing. One, that he is seeing it as affection, because there should be no physical affection between a principal and students in a school. Nothing physical, period. You can speak fondly of them, you can do whatever you want to make their lives better, whatever, but physical affection is not something that's appropriate by any administrator or any teacher or any principal in a school or coach. It's just not appropriate. And especially when the parents say, stop it. Mm-hmm. That administrator, teacher, principal, coach must stop when the parents say that. And so this creates a situation in which they're like, well, what do we do? And they decide, they turn the car around, they're going to go back and confront him.
I love this line. Dudley Do-Right is like, we're the FBI. And that's said so many times during this series. This thing about, what does that mean? We're the FBI, and people are constantly trying to protect. No, the FBI doesn't do this. Well, the FBI does do this. It's just interesting, that identity.
Right.
And what
so
that means to people.
What they say is they're going to actually confront him, and when they do, they walk in there. They say, look, the school board has asked us to speak to you about this. We're advising you to stop the tickling. And he just tries to flip it right on them. It's your perverted minds that are twisting something I'm doing. And then he just rattles off all the accomplishments and how happy the kids are and all that other stuff. And he basically walks away saying, you know, I hope you think long and hard about how you're going to raise your kids when you have them. And, you know, the problem is what he does is say, no, I'm going to keep doing this. And so they didn't have any choice but to actually tell the board, look, this is a problem. And it seems to be that he will not control his behavior, so somebody's got to control it for him.
So as we get after that scene, we see Holden with Deb. You know, she's trying to study, and it's interesting. She's studying a book called The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life by Irving Goffman. And she talks to Holden about, you know, everybody wears masks. We wear masks in our lives and to fit in, to make everybody else comfortable. And Holden is like, well, maybe that's what I'm seeing, is that he's wearing the wrong mask. Like, he's treating this child the way that a parent would at home. And it's making people uncomfortable because it's the wrong mask for that. Like you're saying, it's not appropriate and it's making people uncomfortable. But is that itself a predictor of a crime? And it's something that he seems to be struggling with continuously.
It becomes a predictor when it's outside of his control, when he's told specifically do not do this, and yet he does it again and again and again, and he's rationalizing his behavior, justifying what he's doing, and that's not good. So they go away from that confrontation with the principal, and Dudley says, do we do the right thing? Is this a federal issue? And I'm here to tell you, yes, it is a federal issue. you are in the behavioral science unit. You will soon become part of the National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime, and your mission is to study violent and sexual crimes to help law enforcement across the country and around the world so that they understand this behavior that they don't get to study. And because you're in that position, yes, you do have to lead the charge. You are the tip of the spear, and you're going to have to take some pretty serious decisions about what you should do and what you shouldn't do. And I think the rest of these episodes will kind of also flesh out that same point.
Right.
And if you, you know, put it into a common sense framework, well, let's say, you know, Holden leaves that situation and does nothing. And then in a year's time, there are further reports. And let's say there is an escalation. Well, who's going to be at the center of that criticism? Because there were warning signs, people were telling him. And there's the whole play out with Holden's intuition as well, his intuitive self. Knows that this is creepy, knows that this is a problem. There might not be a crime of tickling, you know, of sorts, but he knows intuitively that it's not right. And when you've got parents who are all complaining, and actually the principal is fairly bullish and bullying in that encounter. It's not just, you know, it's him on the defence trying to rationalise his behaviour, but it's he bullies back rather than listening to the parents who have a right to make their voice is heard because it's their child. So I think it's a very interesting scene. And the mask thing comes up. And I think that also is a nod to the serial killers too, that, you know, people do wear masks and the ability to compartmentalise. And funnily enough, it runs across the theme with the profilers, you know, that they're less than perfect. Not everyone's human. But that comes across, you know, you have to compartmentalize certain things. Everybody does across their life course. And, you know, it's a nod to the fact serial killers don't grow off trees. They don't wake up someday and just decide to start killing people. You know, there is a continuum. There is a pathway of abuse and violence, and trying to understand what those warning signs are. You know, it's the whole point of the behavioral analysis unit and what we were doing at New Scotland Yard. So I think that they're things that I certainly get asked, you know, in different professional settings of what's okay and what's not. But the minute someone, even if it's a child, says it's not okay, then it's not okay, full stop.
Mm-hmm. But here's where Dr. Wendy makes the fatal flaw. She says, I can't imagine why you would go after a respected principal with no history of abuse.
Right.
Anybody here of, I don't know, Larry Nassar? I mean, come on.
Yeah, I mean, that seems... Because she's just not on the ground. This has been established. She doesn't see... She can't feel it. And it must be hard for you when you're out in the field to explain what it is, that gut feeling. You can't write that down.
Right. Well, it's part of... Yeah, it's part of an educated gut instinct. And when you see thousands of these cases over the course of your career... Little tiny nuances can actually set you off, and you listen to your instincts. You train yourself to listen to them. And if you, our listeners, want to do that, you should read Gavin DeBecker's book, The Gift of Fear.
It's excellent.
Right, and Protecting the Gift as well. And those books will help you understand that you should actually listen to your instincts. They are there to protect you.
So back at Quantico, it turns out Agent Squeaky Clean is also a squealer because he's told he feels very guilty about what they've done out in the field. And so he tells the boss what they did. And the boss is like, who do you think? And he just rips him a new one. Has that ever happened to you?
Getting somebody, having somebody rat me out?
Your ass handed to you by somebody. Yeah, by a
I've had a boss who handed my ass and Jim Fitzgerald his ass. When we arrested a guy who was about to be made a top 10 fugitive, they'd been looking for him for 3 years. My training agent gave me the case and told me to find him. And I did. And Jim and I arrested him. And we got screamed at because he said, this guy was supposed to be top 10 and we should have had the whole squad out there. He wanted to get credit. He wanted me to find him.
Gotcha.
And then he wanted to wait till he got named a top 10 and then he would have had a top 10 arrest. So I did get my ass handed to me for that. And it was similarly stupid, ignorant, whatever. So, yeah, there are some bosses in the FBI who shouldn't be there, who have their own problems, and they take it out on their squads.
But how far can
and their
you
own agendas.
Other, yeah, yeah.
how far can you push back though? In this scene, he really, Holden really pushes back. And
yeah,
is
not
like
going to happen.
Very, you know.
Not going to happen. He would have been transferred in 5 minutes. Yeah. That's when you talk about in this episode what's real and not real, that pushback, although John Douglas did a fair amount of that, in that situation where the assistant director tells you, basically orders you to do something and you don't, or you get back in his face, that's called insubordination, and that could end up causing you to get fired. There's a lot of things in these next two episodes to talk about that way.
Okay. So he gets reprimanded by his boss, and then Wendy and Bill, who are dressed amazingly similar in their beige shirts, also are waiting for him like mom and dad, and are like trying to rein him in. Like, dude, you know, you reflect badly on all of us. You cannot, you know, just go off half-cocked on this.
Right. And that's when she says, I can't imagine why you would go after a respected principal mm-hmm. with no history of abuse. And any professional in the field knows that the fact that they have no history, no reported history of abuse, doesn't mean they don't have a history of abuse. In fact, this guy has admitted that he's been doing this for years.
Yeah, and that's a good point. You know, we're talking about reported history, we're talking about history of convictions, you know, and it's very true. Just because there's no intelligence logs or they haven't been convicted for it doesn't mean to say that they're not doing it. And that's why community intelligence is really important. What he's doing, going out into schools and listening to people, their concerns, asking them questions. And intelligence is information for action. And it's important stuff that's turned into action.
So we end the episode with Holden saying to the guy in the school board, yes, you know, I think that this principal's developed a compulsion that he's justifying, and it seems like the school board is going to err on the side of caution and fire him. And we close out with some beautiful music, beautifully distorted music by the composer Jason Bill. I just want to shout out to him. It's like a viola being played underwater. It's amazing. And he got that effect by using a bunch of crystal wine glasses and filling them with water and making that
around the top of the
and just distorting it that way. So it's beyond. Anyway, all right.
Wow,
there you
that's
go.
Amazing. I didn't pick that up at all.
Any recommendations?
Well, go for it.
Well, I just want to give a nod again to Mudbound, just because I saw and I was really excited to see that the first female cinematographer has been nominated, Rachel Williams, and it's for Mudbound, which I thought was very cool. Mary J. Blige for 2 Oscars for supporting actor and for original soundtrack, and Virgil Williams.
Right.
Friend and colleague.
Our buddy, Virgil.
Yeah, for his screenplay. And I've watched it a number of times. You know, it gives me shudders in parts watching it. It's so powerful.
Right.
So powerful.
Tremendous achievement.
So experiential when you're watching it. You're just immersed in it. And
it's completely immersive.
The rain and the mud and the dirt and the, you know, it just brings you down into the earth. It's really amazing.
I haven't seen it yet.
It's very well done. I mean, if you haven't seen it yet, watch it on Netflix and make sure you set aside a couple of hours. And, you know, it really does get to your core. So well done, Virgil and team. I think it's amazing.
Jim, you have a rec?
I hope people will watch Manhunt Unabomber because it's on Netflix as well.
Mm-hmm.
And on February 11th, they will make the decision on the Writers Guild Awards. That we were nominated for. So.
Which is very exciting. Yeah. Congratulations on your nomination.
Thank you. So I hope people watch it. And
So you're nominated. Wait, I didn't know this. Sorry. So tell them again. You're nominated for.
Yeah. So myself and Tony Gittleson and some other writers got nominated for Manhunt Unabomber for long form original series.
Amazing.
That's amazing.
Congratulations.
Jay Clem, killing it.
Well, we'll see. But, you know, yeah, it is actually a great honor.
It's just amazing to be nominated.
Yes. Absolutely. I'm really excited about that. And just to have that kind of recognition is a wonderful thing. Yeah.
Are you going to the
Yeah.
You're going to rent a tux? You're going to look.
Is it like a black
sticky
tie kind of sit down dinner?
I'm probably going to wear a midnight blue
shark
suit with black velvet lapels and a bow tie.
And a hat.
Of course, I'm going to wear my leather hat. Yeah, my black leather hat.
You got to take a selfie for us.
Sounds snappy, Jim C. Sounds very snappy.
So I wanted to give a shout out that I am going to be at the Santa Fe Film Festival February 9th through the 11th. I'm going to be watching lots of films with my friend Aisha Tyler. We're going out there together. Her film Axis is playing there, and she's going to be on a panel. And I am leading a panel of renowned casting directors, and they asked me what the theme was, and I said, I'd like to call it Burn the Couch, Exploding what? Myths in the Entertainment Industry. So I'm super excited about that. If you want to come to my panel, please do. It's going to be on Saturday, February 10th, and you can go to their website to see the actual time.
Awesome.
That sounds great, Lisa. And we should probably say, you know, that if people are interested in coming to CrimeCon, then you should book your tickets because they've been available for a while, and it's the
right,
May 4th.
It's selling out fast, actually. Hopefully there'll still be tickets available. But
when is it, Jim? May 4th to May 6th?
Yes.
And it's
in
Nashville
at the Gaylord.
All right. Well, thanks, you guys.
Yes, thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things that you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcast and leave us a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotion and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go over to Facebook and like our Facebook page. And one last thing is please tell all your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening to us. We really appreciate you.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support, if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline, free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357 or go on their website www.genesisshelter.org or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.
Woo!